I'm very pleased to be able to present to you this evening Professor Peter Draper, who comes to us and has been with us here on the Rhodes campus for about a week and a half now, comes from Birkbeck College in London, where he's been a lecturer in the history of art for a number of years now. Professor Draper took his degrees from King's College, Cambridge, his BA, and then his advanced degrees from the Courtauld Institute in London, one of the lesser slopes of the Olympia in the art historical world. In 1967, he became Conway librarian at the Courtauld Institute, quite a position in itself. And in 1969, then he moved to Birkbeck College. He has worked on and has been largely responsible for putting together the three-volume corpus of the drawings by Parmigianino that was directed by A.E. Popham, Professor Popham. From 1969 to 1972, Professor Draper was the secretary of the British Archaeological Association, and he has extensive publications in the field of medieval English architecture. He was, for a time, editor of the Transactions of the British Archaeological Association, and in 1985 he was elected and is presently the editor of the journal Architectural History, which is the journal of the Society of Architectural Historians of Great Britain. His recent writings have included works on Christopher Wren and on English Baroque architecture, and he's been involved in work on the early 18th century English architect John James. He tells me he's commencing a study now on the interrelationship between patron and architect in the process of architectural design in 18th century England, an extremely fascinating and little understood, little studied subject. It's on the related subject of the dramatic change of taste in English architecture in the early 18th century that Professor Draper is to speak to us tonight, and when he's dealing with his lecture entitled Taste and Politics in Early 18th Century English Architecture. Professor Draper.
I'll just wrap up this mic. You'll forgive me a moment while we get to the small details of it. I hope that's operating satisfactorily. It is, in fact, for me, as much a pleasure as an honour to have been invited to lecture here tonight under the auspices of the Lillian and Maury Moss Endowment, particularly so because I had the pleasure of talking to Mr. Moss about his deeply felt desire to awaken awareness of the arts in the community. And these are aspirations that I share very much. For many years, in fact, more years than I'd care to specify, I've been closely involved with the extramural department of the University of London, and the college where I normally teach at Birkbeck is in fact specifically for students who are in full-time employment and who do take their degrees part-time in the evening. To some extent, however, I shall fail Mr. Moss this evening. And in what I have to say is most unlikely to encourage anybody to go into a gallery. But I venture to hope that it may encourage you to take another look at the architecture of the gallery itself. Could we have the lights and perhaps the first two slides? Now, the dramatic change in architectural fashion, which took place within a generation early in the 18th century, is clearly illustrated, I hope will be in a moment, thank you, with these two, the comparison between Blenheim Palace here on the left, which is of the first decade of the 18th century, and Hocum Hall on the right of the 1730s. Ironically, both the styles represented here placed England in the forefront of European architecture. Blenheim, as an example of the unrivaled freedom of invention within the classical tradition, which was shown by English Baroque architects, and Hocum, as an example of precocious neoclassicism. This change in architectural vocabulary was the outward manifestation of a fundamental change in the theoretical basis on which architectural style was founded. A change which was both precipitated by and made possible as a result of equally important changes in the political context in which architecture was produced. And it's the interrelation of these different aspects that I would want to consider with you tonight. Now, to speak of taste in architecture presupposes definable and recognizable standards or criteria by which architecture may be judged. Now, this could not be said of the piecemeal infiltration, importation, and adoption of Italian and French Renaissance vocabulary in England in the 16th century. But it can certainly be applied to the self-conscious cultivation of an Italianate style at the courts of James I and Charles I with the work of Inigo Jones. Now, this may be illustrated by a comparison between... is that going forward or backwards? Between the banqueting house here on the right and a building called Burton Agnes in Yorkshire, which I just use as an example of a late Elizabethan and a Jacobean house. It's typical in that it has a symmetrical facade, but nothing to match the accomplishment and sophisticated handling of the classical orders of the royal building on your left of about 1620, on which the Conoscenti could both develop and exercise their discernment. This building was part of a deliberate attempt to provide a style for the Stuart court, which could be, and was with varying degrees of success, emulated by courtiers wishing to identify with the court. This image was in fact most successfully portrayed in the portraiture by Sir Anthony van Dyck. Now, the function of the building on the left, of the banqueting house, also provides the clearest indication of the political use of architecture. It was designed primarily to house the performances of the fabulously expensive court masques in which the virtues of divine kingship were extolled. This was a theme taken up in the paintings by Rubens, which were to adorn the ceiling, which were installed in 1635 and showed the apotheosis of James I. This building was also, I may say, to be a case of the triumph of art over function, because it was discovered that the candle smoke, which was coming from these lavish performances, was damaging the paintings, and so the masks had to be held in another building. The banqueting house was a demonstrably political building, an aspect which was recognized in its choice as the backdrop for the execution of Charles I in 1649, and may serve to remind us that in Northern Europe in the 17th century, major architectural enterprises were heavily centered around courts. Of these, the one that set the pace for the rest of Europe was that of Louis XIV at Versailles, where the architecture and decoration acted as a spectacular straitjacket for the elaborate protocol of the court, which was designed to keep the aristocracy under strict surveillance and control. In England, the position was more complex, with the fluctuating fortunes of the court during the 17th century, but the architectural influence of the court was comparably pervasive, ranging from the emulation by the Stuart courtiers to the dominant architectural role of the Office of Works after the Restoration in 1660. Inigo Jones had been Surveyor General of the Royal Works under Charles I, and Sir Christopher Wren was to hold that office from 1669 until he was jobbed out in a political coup in 1718 at the age of 86. It must be remembered that in the 17th century there were no professional architects, as we would understand the term. The equivalent would be these men employed in the offices to oversee the royal works, who then had a very powerful influence on architectural style. And as we shall see, the successful dissemination and ultimate domination of the new style in the early 18th century was made possible by a political coup in the Office of Works from 1718. Another building by Inigo Jones will just serve to show the characteristics of his style, which is to be important in the later part of our story. This is the Queen's House at Greenwich. It was a small villa-type house, A-stylar, in that it had no classical orders except in the porch that you see on the garden front on the right. And it was obviously emulating Palladio, the famous 16th century Italian architect, Palladio's villas in the Veneto. And the important point about Inigo Jones is that he had first-hand knowledge of Italy. He'd even taken with him and annotated a copy of Palladio's Quattro Libri dell'Architettura while visiting Palladio's palaces and villas, though he never slavishly copied, but always reinterpreted Palladio. Yet while Jones was working, architecture in Italy was beginning to change dramatically with the works of the great Baroque artists, Pietro da Cortona, Bernini, and Borromini. But no sign of this new manner appears in Jones's architecture, except perhaps some indication, at least of the Carracci, in his interiors, as, for example, at Wilton House, which is a house near Salisbury, built in the 1650s, not in fact by Jones. It was built by Jones' pupil, John Webb, but in the traditional sense, it was always attributed to Inigo Jones. And you will see from this that there is in fact a very marked contrast between a very simple exterior and a very lavish interior. And this was actually very self-conscious. Indeed, Jones wrote a small passage which I'd just like to read you. Now, this ought to be read in a Welsh accent, but as I can't sustain a good Welsh accent, I will... But please remember that Inigo Jones was Welsh. I'm not Welsh, incidentally, but I just thought there might be a Welshman in the audience. And to say true, he says, all those composed ornaments, the which proceed out of the abundance of designers and were brought in by Michelangelo and his followers, in my opinion, do not dwell in solid architecture and the fasciati, or facades of houses, but are rather in garden loggias, stucco, or ornaments of chimney pieces, or in the inner parts of houses. Those compositions are of necessity to be housed. For, as outwardly every wise man carrieth a gravity in public places, where there is nothing else looked for, as yet inwardly hath his imaginacy set on fire, and sometimes licentiously flying out, as nature herself does oftentimes extravagantly, to delight, amaze us, sometimes move us to laughter, sometimes to contemplation and horror. So, in architecture, the outward ornaments ought to be solid, proportionable, according to the rules, masculine and unaffected. Now, there's a lot in that, and really what it amounts to is a very strong sense of decorum. In other words, what is appropriate to certain parts of a building, or indeed to certain types of buildings. This is an important principle to which I shall return. Now, during the Commonwealth, after the king had been executed, the young Charles II and his court lived in exile in France and Holland, and thus became thoroughly imbued with all aspects of French life, manners, and culture. Not surprisingly, this was to have a very significant influence on architecture after the Restoration. On the left, I show you Clarendon House, a house built in the 1660s, and on the right, a house called Eltham Lodge. Now, Eltham shows strong Dutch influence in the combination of a brick structure and applied classical ornament, and yet it can also be seen as following the simple classicism of Inigo Jones. Much the same could be said of the exterior of Clarendon House, which was built about 1664 but demolished less than 20 years later after the sudden downfall of the Earl of Clarendon. It was bought up by property developers, incidentally, one led by a man called Bond, and that is the origin of Bond Street, which is now partly on the site of Clarendon House. The simplicity of the exterior belied the extravagant richness of the interior, which was probably closer at least, to that of Wilton. Unfortunately, we know nothing more about this house except this engraving. But this A-stylar house, in other words, a house designed without any classical pilasters at all, although designed within a classical system of proportions and symmetry, was to form the standard type for the middle range of landowning gentry, at least up till about 1700. Now, the more elaborate architectural vocabulary appropriate to grand building had to be taken from French practice, for none of the major English architects visited Italy before about 1700. So their knowledge of Italian architecture was entirely through the medium of engravings. But France, at this period, had much to offer, as Wren discovered when he visited Paris in 1665, where, incidentally, he met Bernini, who was there to try to get the commission for the Louvre. And he had a few minutes' sight of Bernini's designs for the Louvre. But this was to be Wren's only trip abroad. Later in life, he was to advise his son against travelling. He said, it just isn't worth the effort. But it did, in fact, he drew upon this experience throughout his life. One could go on numerous examples. I will just simply show one because it's relevant to points I wish to make later. On the left is the Collège des Quatre Nations by Levaux, which was then the Collège de Mazarin. And on the right is a design that Wren drew up for Greenwich when they were designing a royal hospital in the 1690s. And it was from, for example, Levaux that Wren derived this practice of having a kind of cour d'honneur, a splendid courtyard in the front, leading up to the sort of climax of a large portico in the center, and then that's surmounted by a dome. In the case of the college, it was the dome of a church. In Wren's case, he transported that simply to a vestibule between the chapel and the dining room. So he put it into a secular context, but the idea and the vocabulary came very specifically from France. But in this regard, Wren's designs are very often much more interesting than the executed buildings, which all too often were compromised by lack of funds and political constraints, which rendered it impossible for Charles to make his royal buildings as outwardly and manifestly magnificent as Louis XIV. None of Charles II's palaces at Greenwich, Windsor, or Winchester has survived. But if I show you here Hampton Court, which was built for William III, it's a restrained building, restrained, in fact, to the point of dullness, and it's, in fact, but a dim reflection of the grandeur of Wren's original designs. This facade, however, does show one feature, which was to become an identifying characteristic of palatial building, the flat balustrade masking a low-pitched roof. In other words, the building has, the top is surmounted by a continuous horizontal balustrade. You can't see the roof. It's a low-pitched roof behind, whereas all the buildings we've showed you up to now, you could actually see the roof, and the roof formed quite an important part of the design. Now, the obvious place from which this design was taken is, of course, that of Versailles, where, again, once the design near towards 1700 had been completed, that too had got to the point of dullness, but it was enhanced a little by the use of a giant order, a large series of columns on the main floor, which gave it the requisite grandeur. But this idea of a balustrade, very often surmounted by statues, became a standard type of buildings of a certain status. Now, Charles II, like William later, could, however, pay more attention to the interior of their palaces. On the left is the staircase to the king's apartments at Hampton Court, painted by Verrieux about 1700, 1701. And on the right, taken from a 19th century tinted engraving, the interior of the chapel of Charles II's remodeling at Windsor of the 1680s. It's a tragic loss that we have no longer the buildings that Charles remodeled there, because clearly the interiors were extremely lavish. Now, these interiors demonstrated the full array of Baroque illusionism and extravagant painted ornament to match the comparably extravagant iconography. A similar chapel to that at Windsor had been constructed in the Palace of Whitehall for Catherine of Braganza and her retinue, and that was burnt in the Great Fire of 1698, but John Evelyn recorded his impressions of it. He couldn't help but admire the artistry, but his Protestant soul was shocked to the core by what he thought as a flagrant display of popery. There is, however, a surviving chapel which gives some indication of what this may have looked like. But what is remarkable about this is that it is not in a royal palace. It is, in fact, in a grand country house built by a major landowner. It's at Chatsworth. In contemporary France, this would have been a serious case of lèse majesté. But nothing could demonstrate more clearly the political power of the English aristocracy than they could emulate so closely the sumptuous decoration reserved elsewhere in Europe for royalty. The south front of Chatsworth was no less grand, and its flat balustrade, surmounted by urns here, and the giant Ionic order, these big pilasters which articulate the facade at either end, show exactly the same palatial aspirations. It is unusual, however, in that it has an even number of bays, so that there is no centre. But if you look at the aerial view of an engraving done just in the very early years of the 18th century, you will see that the formal garden, which was once in front of it, provided a very strong central axis. And it reminds us again that so often the loss of these formal gardens has actually deprived us of much of the effect of the architecture, since they were so very closely related during the 17th and 18th centuries. At Chatsworth, incidentally, the craftsmen The architect and the team of craftsmen that decorated the sumptuous interiors were all hired from the Office of Works. Now, for a really neat correlation between architectural style and politics, it would be convenient if we could date this presumption on the part of the English aristocracy to coincide with the Glorious Revolution of 1688, when James II was expelled and William of Orange established as king. Unfortunately, history is not so neat, for the south front of Chatsworth was begun in 1687. But as a reflection of de facto political authority, the rebuilding of Chatsworth belongs very much in that political context. Chatsworth was the first such grand country house, but others rapidly followed, and a clear demonstration of the significance which was attached to this architectural vocabulary is provided by a building called Easton Neston. I'm sorry, this slide on the right is a little dark. Now, this is an impressive, though not particularly large, house in Northamptonshire. Now, the model, which I show you on the left, was made when the house was first designed in the 1680s, and it shows, in all probability, a standard brick house with stone dressings for the corners, for windows and door frames. But while the house was under construction, the owner purchased the barony of Leinster and married extremely successfully, bringing the wife, the Earl of Danby, who brought with her, reputed, at £10,000. And so the design of the house was suitably modified before the facades were finished. And in the completed building, although I'm afraid this, you may have to take this with the eye of faith rather than anything else, the house was faced with stone, not brick, and a giant order was applied to the building, and the characteristic flat balustrade hiding the low-pitched roof was added. You see, you can see the roof on the model. The roof disappears on the completed building. In other words, the architectural vocabulary has been altered to interline with the changed social position of the owner. Now, two further examples will suffice to show how far this palatial grandeur could be taken. At Castle Howard in Yorkshire, which is the first house to be designed by the playwright turned architect Sir John Vanbrugh, the house is planned with a cour d'honneur, as you see from the plan, there's a splendid entrance courtyard, and it culminates in a domed centrepiece, and I show you the entrance facade on the right-hand slide. That facade has a complex articulation of rusticated masonry with a giant Doric order, rather severe Doric order for the facade, which contrasts very deliberately, in fact, with the garden facade of the building, where the rooms of parade are arranged in a long suite enfilade in the French manner, and the facade is more richly decorated with a Corinthian order and a great deal more surface sculptural ornament, so that we have the sense of decorum again between the difference in an entrance facade and the garden facade. And that sense of surface ornament and that rather flat arrangement in the center of the structure is, in fact, very obviously derived, ultimately, from Marly, which was the smaller palace which Louis XIV built a couple of miles north of Versailles and was about the nearest that Louis came to informality. It was, as you see, an extremely rich house in terms of its surface ornament in a characteristic French manner, and that design was, in a sense, taken over but modified at Castle Howard. I think there's no doubt there's be some connection there. But undoubtedly the grandest of all these country houses was Blenheim, which was built by a grateful nation for the Duke of Marlborough as a national monument to the victories over the armies of Louis XIV, of which Blenheim had been a major example. Now, this function is closely reflected in both the form and the decoration of the building, starting with the bastion-like formal garden. If I can just negotiate this Elvis library. This is the house. You see, the aerial view shows you the size of the house now. That is the old plan. This was the garden wall. And that garden wall was well over 1,000 feet across there. It was an enormous walled garden, but of course it was, as you see from the side, really bastion-like. I mean, it was designed well like a castle. And for those of you who are addicted to Tristram Shandy, you will notice that it would be an absolute paradise for Uncle Toby. But it, again, is very important because it was swept away with the change in taste in the 18th century with Capability Brown, when the lake was put in and the lawns brought up to the house. And once again, it was victim to a change of taste in the mid-18th century in landscape gardening. The Blenheim as it stands, however, has all the traditional connotations of the classical orders very clearly demonstrated. The use of the Doric order, which was said by the Roman theorist Vitruvius to be appropriate to the warlike Mars, and the Corinthian order appropriate to victory. The sculptural decoration, and this building is not easy to see, but in the pediments and either side of the door case, of trophies, of shields and spears and so on, takes up the theme. And the coup de grace is, in fact, the something very hard to see here, but that is a bust of Louis XIV, which was captured at one of the battles. But what is also interesting about Blenheim is the architectural vocabulary which it shows. If we take a look just at the entrance to the kitchen courtyard, which is a little further around the central courtyard, if we followed the slide on the right a little further around, you'd come to this facade here. And it's on this that the architectural vocabulary becomes extraordinarily free. It becomes very inventive, very expressive, and finds no parallel in contemporary Europe. If you note particularly the massive structures of chimneys, the way in which they're articulated, and to try to describe in conventional architectural terms any of these features from here up is actually very nearly impossible. But that freedom, of course, was a very important part of the architectural style as it stood. Now, so far we've been looking at architecture in the general political context of the relationship between the court and the great land-owning aristocracy. But can we refine this any further and consider architectural style in relation to party politics? Chatsworth, Castlehard, and Blenheim were all put up by the Whig aristocrats who supported the Glorious Revolution of 1688. But what of the Tories? Well, at this time, many of these kept a fairly low profile in view of their Jacobite sympathies and their Catholic leanings. But in 1710, a Tory government was formed. And this new government passed an act for the building of 50 new churches in London as a grand gesture by the establishment to combat what they saw as the rising tide of nonconformism in the newly populated areas to the east of London, as this nonconformism was felt to be fostering political as well as religious sedition. Now, so grand and demonstrative were these churches that only 12 of the intended 50 were actually built. And ironically, they were built for the most part by the Whigs, because the Tory government was a very short-lived one and fell quite soon afterwards. But the designs were chosen and provide a very illuminating cross-section of current architectural styles. This is St. Mary le Strand, a delightful little church in a little island site in the centre of the Strand in London, designed by James Gibbs. Now, for the Tory Commission, James Gibbs must have seemed the ideal architect. Recently returned from several years training in Italy, Gibbs was nevertheless sensitive to the achievements of Christopher Wren and quoted freely from Wren's works. St. Mary is a beautifully detailed and highly accomplished little church, but with its elaborate architectural vocabulary and particularly its interior plasterwork, it smacked too much of popery for contemporary Protestant taste. Gibbs, however, was a Catholic, and when the Tory government fell and the makeup of the commission changed, he lost his post as one of the surveyors, or architects as we would probably say, and for much of his professional life he was dependent on the patronage of prominent Tories like Edward Harley. This church, which is St. John's, Smith Square, was built by Thomas Archer, a gentleman amateur architect whose main income came from a lucrative sinecure at court, where he was, among other responsibilities, in charge of all gambling. Archer was a talented architect who travelled extensively in Europe, experience which shows in the architectural vocabulary he employed. You may note particularly the use here of the simpler Doric order, as opposed to the Ionic and Corinthian that was employed by Gibbs at St. Mary le Strand. But six of the 12 churches were designed by Nicholas Hawksmoor, a former assistant of Wren who'd worked closely with Vanbrugh at Castle Howard and at Blenheim. And to achieve the required sense of grandeur, Hawksmoor chose a much more austere monumentality. We may take, for example, the exterior of Christ Church Spitalfields. church which is in the process of being restored now, having very nearly decayed to the point of collapse. But it's interesting to note that Hawksmoor's approach accords very closely with a set of proposals that was submitted by Sir John Vanbrugh to the commissioners to serve as general guidelines. I'd like to quote one or two parts of this because I think it's indicative of the intention behind this architecture.